Hello, everyone. I am Eric Filion from the Department of History at Queen's University. This is the first of five episodes prepared for Curating for Change, the work that music festivals do in the world. A two-part online conference hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University. We held the first part at the end of August. Part two will take place in October. Our primary objective with this conference is to bring together a diverse set of perspectives from leading scholars, artists, festival organizers, and patrons to extend our understanding of the work that independent, artist-run, or boutique music festivals do in promoting vital forms of activist arts-based practices, pedagogies, and community making. The first episode was recorded on August 26th. It is a conversation between Candace Hopkins and Alan Grayeyes. Candace Hopkins is a citizen of Carcass, Tagish First Nation. She lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Her writing and curatorial practice explores the intersections of history, contemporary art, and indigeneity. She is executive director of Forge Project at Ancram, New York, and senior curator of the 2022 edition of the Toronto Biennial of Art. Alan Grayeyes runs the artist and project management company Ogishida Arts and produces the Sakihiwe Festival. A member of Pigas First Nation, he received a 2020 Manitoba Arts Award of Distinction from the Manitoba Arts Council and the 2020 Kevin Walters Legacy Award from Manitoba Music for his work with Indigenous artists and organizations in Canada. Let's listen.
You know, I think that there's many directions our conversation can take, obviously, but Alan, I wanted to point to something that you brought up, and that was how, you know, in some of the topics you're speaking about, how the work that we do and the work you do in particular provides a kind of stage for Indigenous folks. Like, how do you describe that? How do you define that? I'm really interested in how, you know, our work is not necessarily about space making, but it's actually about changing the codes of conduct altogether.
Yeah, I'm a firm believer that every stage gives us an opportunity to educate Canadians and Americans and show them that we're just as special and unique as their loved ones. And for me, that extends to personal safety and well-being, and also the access to resources and everything we do. It's about challenging stereotypes and challenging the status quo again. So I think every stage we're in front of hundreds, if not thousands of people, and it gives us such a powerful platform. And so I really consider myself as somebody who tries to influence the artists and help them educate. Like, I love not necessarily reading. I'm not very good at reading, but I love listening. I learn through listening. And so I'm a big fan of audiobooks. And so whenever I find a good audiobook, I often purchase it and send it off to a couple other folks as well, just to make sure that, you know, they have powerful messages to share on stage. Like, I remember how many people amplified Jeremy Dutcher's message from the Juno Awards or the Polaris Music Prize. And that just, again, is a reinforcement of that idea that every stage is super powerful.
Yeah, and I think you and I probably have different understandings of stage, because I guess I work as exhibitions. So I understand exhibitions as a kind of form of a stage in a way, maybe of a different kind. And, you know, one turn that myself and other folks have been talking about is, and I'm curious whether this is taking place, you know, in a lot of conversations with your colleagues, Alan, and that is, you know, the turn, and this is something Marie pointed to in the introduction, the turn towards, not even just a turn towards, you know, how do we practice decolonial listening? This is a question that I put forward a lot. You know, you've spoken about listening and, you know, and following my colleague Dylan Robinson, decolonization is he believes something that is necessarily intersectional. It's also necessarily something embodied. We know from Tuck and Wang that it's a verb, not a metaphor, obviously. I think for me, I have put forward that question in my work because I'm interested in it as a provocation. But now a lot of my colleagues, including Steve Loft, who was most recently helped form the the new direction at the Canada Council for the Arts. It's kind of a turn towards anti-colonialism. So that is that I think for a lot of us, this feeling that the decolonial always already puts us in the framework of the colonial, whereas the anti-colonial is a way to celebrate those things, whether sonic or not, those practices that do not necessarily share that framework, because they might be older songs, for example, or songs that we've carried with us, or stories that we've carried with us. But also, you know, it's a way of not giving power to that kind of colonial framework. So I think that's something that we've been interested in exploring, what we consider, you know, whether there might be like now kind of like anti-colonial scores, not just resistance scores, but ones that, you know, honor the way that music has always shaped our lives. And I think that Jeremy Dutcher is actually really good example of this, the way that he's citing the archive, not just in his live performances, but in his recorded work too. And speaking with those voices on stage, and say that that's a form of anti-colonialism.
Yeah, I think like for me, it really comes down to not so much the music, but the way that we present it. And I think like I'm always, I've been saying this for a long time, and to anybody who listens, but it's that we need more public support for competition powwows. And in Canada, we have the Canadian Arts Presentation Fund. Unfortunately, competition prize money is not eligible. And I'm a firm believer that we need to change, the government needs to change the way they fund the arts, instead of forcing us to change the way we participate and present the arts. And the powwow is, again, a decolonial, I think it would be considered decolonial or anti-colonial way of presentation and participation, in that you have the freedom as an audience member to walk around. You have the freedom to participate in inter-travel. You can go and stand next to the drums. And I'm also a believer in breaking down the classroom and the deconstructing the classroom as much as possible. And when we present music in concert halls or in festival fields, we're asking people to sit quietly, just like they do in school. And so like a lot of the stuff that I do with the Sagawe Festival is taking music to low-income neighborhoods that these kids don't have access to the arts. And again, like these families oftentimes have participated in powwows, and so they want that freedom. They don't want to sit in a classroom desk or in a seat and just be projected at or performed to. They want to participate. And so for me, it's about finding a way to convince our funding partners to change the way that they support the arts. And I'm a firm believer, again, that the competition powwows is our biggest nationwide network, similar to the network that we see with folk festivals or jazz festivals across the country. And again, it's unfortunate that we just don't have access to that same level of support.
Well, it's almost like you're making the case to recast powwows as a music festival. Like what would happen if people started thinking about them that way?
Yeah, exactly. And what would happen if we had the same level of support for these festivals? I believe that we would see the like singers being able to do music full time. Like on top of the work that I do with the Sagawe Festival, I also help Northern Cree with their business. And these guys have 8 Grammy nominations. They have 40 albums to their credit. Unfortunately, none of them can afford to do music as a full-time job because there isn't that nationwide network of folk festivals that are publicly supported and have the ability to develop audiences over multiple generations. Is a significant head start as Indigenous organizations when we're competing against our Canadian counterparts. And unfortunately, it is a competition for public support. It's also a competition for corporate contributions, our private contributions. And again, when we're an organization with one person employed with no operating, we're one operating grant now from Canada Council. The other problem with that system is that at the operating grant level, it's by invitation only. And so if you didn't get into that program in the 90s or in the early 2000s, if you launched your organization way later in the game, then you don't even get the same level of support or stability.
Yeah, I used to work at an artisan center called Western Front, and that was the situation then. It reminds me, and this might seem a little far afield, Alan, but I remember there's a book that was published, I think, by Art Metropole a long time ago, called Museums by Artists. And I think this essay is in that book, and it's called The Humiliation of Bureaucrat. And it's an essay by A. Bronson, who was a member of the famous artist collective in Canada called General Idea. And The Humiliation of the Bureaucrat was an amazing essay. It's an amazing essay to reread, because basically what he was saying was that even though all these artists at the time, you know, 60s, late 60s, early 70s, got together to make what they felt was an alternative system to the mainstream, which was the formation of artist-owned centers across Canada, they all eventually generated administrative systems that replicated the funding structures, right? Yeah. And so that's what's happening right now, it sounds like. And so it makes me wonder, like, what will it take for, instead of just us lobbying for, you know, to be part of this grandfathered in funding model, what will it take for the whole idea of how music festivals are funded, for example, to shift, right? Like, you know, because it puts us at a disadvantage if we're trying to fit ourselves into a model that already isn't expansive enough to understand powwow as a music festival. Yeah. So, you know, what leverage do you have? What do we put forward? How do you reshape that, I guess, is my question.
I don't know how you reshape it, but I am I love the idea of the two-row wampum belt as the kind of that meme that that instructs us on how the resources were originally envisioned to be shared. And so there's two canoes and two nations, essentially, and we share the wealth. Or also the Dish with One Spoon Treaty. I love that idea. And again, I think we've seen the national or the Indigenous Screen Office here in Canada get a significant amount of support, but based on the per capita idea. And so Indigenous people are maybe 5% per capita of Canada. And so they wanted 5% of the arts funding for the organization. I thought that was good, but again, it if we're talking about like big vision and how we're really going to reframe it, I think it is going back to the original understanding of our ancestors, or a lot of the ancestors from our nations, or some of our nations, and that's the shared access to the resources. And we're probably not going to get there. And but again, if that's what we're asking, like, how do we reshape it? It is the sharing of the resources.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I write a lot about potlatch as an Indigenous economy. Obviously, we have many Indigenous economies, and ones that you're pointing to are treaties that were based on, you know, sovereign nations, agreements between sovereign nations. With potlatches, of course, I think, you know, what's interesting about that is the expanded understanding of what wealth is. It's not necessarily monetary, but it's actually for the well-being of the community. That's what economy should enable, is the well-being of a community.
Yeah, definitely. I think that speaks to tradition and the ideas for some nations that traditions are practices that evolve to support the well-being of the family. That's one of the things that we kind of frame as in our festival is how is this going to affect families, and so that informs our decisions, and so that informs like how much we offer an artist, how much we pay people to come and help with production assistant roles, and everything is like we need to keep Indigenous families at the center of everything we do. But I think we're adapting for the Indigenous Music Office as well, is having Indigenous families at the core of every decision we make.
That's amazing. I think that that's already enacting, you know, a different kind of model. You know, in working in the arts in Canada for so many years, we worked with CARFAC, which I think people know well. And sometimes people forget that CARFAC was actually started by a collective of regional artists. They were working out of London, Ontario. Greg Curnow was one of those artists, among others. They were also involved in, I think, one of the longest running experimental music groups, which is the Nihilist Spasm Band, which still perform now, speaking of music. But I think that what you're pointing to, and this is something we're trying to do too in an organization I'm involved in now called Forge, which is, we're in the Hudson Valley. We're in a place of great displacement. This is the lands of the Mohikaniuk people, so the people of the waters that are never still, and that's their description of the Hudson. But they were displaced all the way to Wisconsin. So, you know, you have this, this idea of operating on homelands. How do you generate, I guess, these different ideas of economies and access and wealth here? And, you know, where we're thankfully, or not thankfully, I don't know, the US has a very different model. Like, we don't have granting systems in the same way at all. So a lot of it is based on private patronage. And maybe that gives the opportunity to reframe patronage too. So these are all questions that we're thinking through right now, what I'm doing.
That's really interesting. Like, patronage for me is just out of my realm right now. Like, honestly, if I'm asking for something, I want to be able to give back. I think reciprocity, again, is a very kind of generic value for, or a value that a lot of Indigenous nations share and Indigenous families. And so, again, when I'm approaching a corporate sponsor, I want to make sure that I have the capacity to give back.
Well, I'm curious, and you can answer this or not, Alan, this might be going into too deep, but I'm curious, like, as Native people now, especially in the era of so-called reconciliation, and reconciliation, of course, to me is a problematic term because, you know, what is there to reconcile? Like, we don't want to go back to the point of contact. That's not where we want to go to. But, you know, how do we, I think that actually gives us leverage. You know, it's a national mandate in Canada. So when you're negotiating with corporations, do you try to also, it's not just about getting funding or support, do you try to shift something within the way they work, right? Because a lot of corporations are based on extractive colonialism of various forms. Like, whenever there's a disparity in wealth, there's exploitation somewhere down the line, and a lot of that exploitation is actually our land. That's a question that I've always thought for myself and, you know, tried to enact in very minor ways. But, you know, I think that we're in the era now that when we ask for something from a corporation, it shouldn't just be money. Like, maybe we want to, you know, ask, like, what are you doing in this land for this, you know, beyond performative land acknowledgments or something like that. Like, that's a question.
we don't accept contributions from TD and RBC right now. They are the banks that are investing in the pipelines, which again displace Indigenous communities, regardless of how many of the First Nations said that they signed on for the pipelines. I think if there's one or there's traditional hereditary chiefs involved in communities, then we need to respect them and support them. And I think by not accepting their contributions, and I often talk to the partners and committees that I'm on about sending a similar message to TD and RBC, is that, you know, if you want to support the arts, you want to support music, then you need to reconsider what you're doing with the pipeline across Canada. Because again, I think, like, if we've got powerful stages, we've got the ability to send messages. Like, as nonprofits, we exist to make the world a better place. So it's our job to do this kind of work. And so again, that's one of the main things that kind of holds us back, but again, is one of the contributing factors to the head start that our Canadian counterparts have on us. Is some of them don't necessarily have the same beliefs or the values of when it comes to accepting contributions from corporate partners.
That's great to hear. I think that, you know, in embedding these kinds of ethics into the ask that we do as organizations is incredibly important. And I do feel like, you know, as Native organizations now, we have some leverage that we didn't have before to shape the conversations, to shape, you know, practices, to make structural change and shifts. One of the conversations that's on the table a lot here, particularly in the US and in Canada, certainly is around land back. And so having people think about how that's actionable, is it possible, you know, to do reciprocal relationships with First Nations, you know, as part of the work that you do, is that a form? Like, can we think of land back as something that is not only land-centered, but to expand it to thinking about custodianship. You know, can an organization have a custodial relationship to the place where it's on? And I know this is getting a little bit outside of, you know, our framework on music, but I do think that it's part of, you know, organizational responsibility and creating a kind of protocols or ethics. For example, when Dylan and I were working on Soundings, we actually developed protocols for the exhibition, and we developed what we called curatorial protocols that are shared with every host institution. And we developed our own, you know, kind of score, the way that the exhibition unfolds in time and over space. And the curatorial protocols, I think, were kind of fascinating because they were kind of organizer to organizer, a kind of framework for the work that we will do together, a kind of, you know, reciprocal agreement, perhaps, in part because, particularly in the US, where conversations around Indigenous art tend to be very regional, whether it's the Southwest, Northwest Coast, I say Oklahoma, here in the Northeast, but then there, and in the Midwest as well, but then there's other parts where, you know, we might be working with an institution that has never hosted anything related to contemporary Native art before in their history. So, you know, how do you embark on those relations? And, you know, maybe that's a form of treaty making too, or maybe that's a form of like, you know, let's build this, if we want to call it a stage, let's build this stage together. But I'm thinking about that more and more, like, how do we embed protocols in our work? How do we create leverage, you know, even in the very basic things that we might do, like Alan, what you've already said about the way that you're like trying to put families first, you know, in your organizing. So I'm kind of curious about that. Is that something you see, you know, your work taking is kind of land and sovereignty? Is that increasingly embedded in, I see this increasingly embedded in musicians' practices. Is that something that's becoming at the foreground of, you know, any of the organizing that you're doing?
I'm not really too sure. I'm kind of lost in the conversation now, but I did want to say something. I wanted to say that, and I like just sharing this. I can't remember who told me in the beginning, and I went and looked it up and I Googled it, and it seems to be correct. But 89% of the land in Canada is publicly held. We're not asking for people to give up their vacation homes or their Tim Hortons locations. We're asking for access to the resources and a share of the resources and opportunities to develop and build our own economies. And so I think like, and that's a message again that I've tried to share with multiple artists, and so that they can share that message and amplify that and let people know that, you know, supporting Indigenous people and their efforts to reclaim land and culture and resources is not gonna negatively affect them off like all the time. Sometimes it will. There will be some uncomfortable conversations and agreements that have to be made. But yeah, I think it is an important thing to note that 80% is publicly held.
And sorry, that wasn't even a question, Alan. That was just like a train of
I'm learning lots too. So like honestly, I feel like in Winnipeg and in music especially, I'm in a bit of a bubble where there's not a lot of intellectual conversation like this. So I'm learning a lot. So I really appreciate this. And it's given me a lot of things to research and look for as well. But also like I was a part of the Canadian Live Music Association just released, I think earlier this year, they released a new study called Closing the Gap. In that I was able to contribute some calls to action for presenters across the country.
And amazing.
More specific to Canada, and because we have again great grants here, and for a lot of Indigenous artists, I caught a bit of the last conversation, the tail end, where we were talking about equity and diversifying the stage, which again is really important. And I think Closing the Gap, some of the recommendations or the call to actions had that in mind. I think we need to get artists contracted well in advance of the Canada Council tour deadlines. I don't know how many artists I've helped over the last 17 years who have never even had the opportunity to submit a competitive tour grant application to the Canada Council. And when we can't get those applications in or get that same level of support as our Canadian counterparts, then we can't advance shows well, like on time. I think it creates really crazy cash flow challenges. for the artists. And like with Northern Cree, they're just wrapping up a summer tour. They were on the road almost every weekend. They had a gig, and it's like up to 17 singers at a time. And so they don't have credit cards. And so a lot of it has gone on my personal Visa when it comes to booking flights. And so that cash flow challenge alone has been incredible. We're just like, we're spread so thin because we just don't have that same nationwide network, that those nationwide touring networks. We don't have artists that are making more than a couple $100,000 a year. And so that doesn't help you pay the bills or focus on artist management. And so there's just a number of trickle down effects that the inequality and the head start that our Canadian counterparts have on us.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there's a major gap in the ability to access professional resources too, right, for artists.
There is, and I think it's also a thing with our families as well. I think like a lot of us still have family members that we're taking care of. And so I often, like when I'm doing panels like this, I often try to acknowledge my mom, because without my mom, I wouldn't be able to operate at this level. If I had to deal with the intergenerational trauma, with the mental health issues of my family members and circle, then I wouldn't be able to do this. I'd be up late at night. I wouldn't be able to sleep as well. And so without my mom taking care of the challenges within our family that are a direct result of residential schools, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to do this. And so those are the realities for a lot of folks. And as an Indigenous organization, I respect that as well, even for the people who are just coming in to do production assistant work, is like oftentimes like bad things happen in their families overnight. And so they can't make it in the next day. And so there's a lot of things that contribute to our make things challenging for us.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've just pointed out like some like basically cultural literacy, like we would do when I was working on this big project with Edmonton Arts Council on designing, I think still the only Indigenous art park in North America, as far as we know. It's called Ainu River Lot 11. Ainu's a Cree word, and then River Lot 11 was in reference to Joseph McDonald, who's the first Métis script holder in that exact place. But, you know, little things like when people came to meetings, you pay them in cash because mm-hmm. they need cash and they need to be paid immediately, you know, especially elders. There was a lot of expectation, because this happens a lot. It might happen to you too, Alan. It used to happen to me, but now I refuse for us to give our knowledge for free. So when you're asked to do a lot of committees, and it's just expected that you give your knowledge. And we had to reframe that. And we also had to, what I argued for, and I'm proud of this, is that, you know, when you ask elders to do things, pay them at the same rate that the city pays their consultants.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I appreciate all the arguments that you've made, because it's definitely helped me get paid for work like that. So it's, I think I often think of myself as like a second or third generation arts administrator in the Indigenous community, and I benefit from a lot of the work that people have done before my time. And so it's or people with people who are more articulate like yourself.
I don't think I was articulate at all. Sorry.
That was Candace Hopkins and Alan Gray Eyes. Thank you for listening. What is the work that music festivals do in the world? Could music festivals spark changes in behaviors or institutions? What about policies or even ways of being? Please join us for our online conference featuring artists, scholars, practitioners, and organizers. Co-hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University, Curating for Change, the Work That Music Festivals Do in the World is an online conference that will take place on October 14th and 15th. To find out more, visit whatmusicfestivalsdo.ca.